Welcome to episode 19 of The Grey NATO, a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving gear, and most certainly watches. I'm James Stacey.
And I'm Jason Heaton. Today's topic is watch accessories. That is, tools, loops, winders, cases, travel bits, bracelets. Pretty much anything you could add to or use with a watch. But James, I think, you know, we got a lot to cover here. Let's jump right in. I think maybe the best way to organize this is to kind of nip off, different categories one by one. And I think the logical place to start is probably with straps.
Yeah, let's do straps.
Under which, you know, there are categories within that category as well. I mean, I think, you know, given the name of our show, The Grey NATO, I think you and I are both big NATO strap fans. And, you know, I'm wearing a NATO strap right now, and I'm guessing you are as well.
For sure.
A lot of brands out there. I've got a bag. I've just got a massive Ziploc full of NATO straps. And every time I think I've got enough, I see another cool one or another color or some size that I need that I end up, you know, buying another one.
Yeah, NATOs are kind of a strange thing because it actually, I don't know about you, but it took me quite a few years to come around to NATOs.
Yeah, me too.
When I first got into watches, it was all about the bracelet.
Mm-hmm.
And then I quickly kind of learned that depending on the time of year, bracelets aren't that great. And you know, when I first started, I was starting with very entry-level watches and the bracelets could be very rough.
Yeah. I think bracelets are... You know, now I guess we're going into bracelets, but I mean, I think bracelets are easy to kind of, the easy thing about bracelets is taking on and off, but I don't think they work well in really sort of active situations, which is, I think, where NATO straps really shine.
Yeah, for certain. And yeah, like I said, it just took me a while to get to NATOs, but now that I'm there, it's easily my favorite way of wearing a watch, and you can go, just by changing the color, you can really change the kind of vibe of the NATO from kind of eccentric with a bright red or a yellow to something kind of more stoic like the gray or a little warmer like a brown
mm-hmm.
or a sand or, you know, khaki. They all have the kind of their own topics. And I think anyone that follows my Instagram knows that my general kind of NATO of choice these days is from Toxic NATOs, which is based out of Colorado, a gentleman named Terry, who I had the great pleasure of meeting this past week.
Oh, cool.
But the Toxic stuff is just, it's kind of the hardiest NATO that I've come across. Great hardware, much nicer hardware than your standard $10 Amazon or eBay NATO. I used one, you know, for pretty much the entire summer, so all sorts of sweat. I took one on each trip up Baker. I used a NATO, or I guess one trip was Toxic Royal, which is like a NATO, but it's just a single piece.
Oh yeah,
with a soft loop, like a soft keeper at one end, and then the second time I used the rubber NATO, which we've spoken about before, certainly.
Yeah, no, I've got a Toxic on as we speak here, and it's like you. I mean, I've pretty much worn one of the three or four Toxic NATOs that I own all summer in both 22 and 20 millimeters, and you know, the first thing that struck me about the Toxic NATOs is the buckle alone is big. I mean, so many NATOs that you get have these kind of flimsy little buckles, and I think maybe that's just based on tradition. I think some people like that. It kind of has that, you know, like if you look at ones from kind of the classic brand, which is Phoenix out of the UK, which arguably made the original G10 strap that we've come to know as the NATO strap for the British Ministry of Defense.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, you look at those Phoenix straps and you line one up next to a Toxic and it looks, you know, the hardware looks fairly flimsy. I mean, they're great straps. I love the Phoenix straps. But I think as NATO straps have become more popular and you're getting more brands out there, the companies are actually kind of one-upping each other with hardware, I think is where you can kind of make a difference.
Yeah, I think it's hardware, and then there's definitely a difference in the sort of weave. If you've seen the kind of expensive NATO from Omega,
mm-hmm.
it's much more like a seatbelt sort of weave.
Yeah.
Very nice strap, but there's just simply no, aside from having, say, a branded strap for your Speedmaster, there's really no reason to spend that much on a NATO. You could have a whole collection of NATOs for that much money.
Yeah.
For me, I think I have three brands that I wear with some frequency. I really like the Toxic ones. They're my go-to.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a handful from Crown and Buckle.
Oh, yeah. Me too.
Which I like quite a bit. Their premium NATO is really nice. The hardware is sewn in, so it's a little bit more secure than something that uses a spring buckle.
Yeah.
Like the Toxic. That's a little bit more classic NATO to have the sewn-in buckle.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, you have choices when you buy that strap as far as the finishing of the buckle and those sorts of things. And I've been very happy with those, and I've bought those for friends or people who want to try a NATO or their first few NATOs. And then I have a couple of the Phoenix G10s, and they're simply fantastic. And I think if you're wearing kind of a true military watch, that's kind of the nicest way to do it, is on the correct strap. That said, I'm, like I said, most of the time I'm reaching for a Toxic, and I'm looking at my watch box now, and, you know, of 6 or 7 watches that are out, 7 of them are on Toxic NATOs. So that's just, and it's, you know, there's something that just kind of works about them. I really love the hardware. I love the way that if you do use them hard enough to get some fraying,
mm-hmm. just burn them.
Yeah, just hit them with a lighter just for a split second, and it seals it right up. Just a really nice quality strap for the money. I like that they're, you know, based relatively local in North America, and I kind of like the attitude of their website. If you haven't been to the Toxic NATO's website, be sure to check it out, and we'll throw a link to anything we talk about. To make it clear, nothing that we're talking about tonight, we've not been paid by any of these people.
Yeah, it's just all stuff we've it's been all trial and error.
You know, these are all brands that we've purchased and supported in some way or another, and you know, these are products that we own via the conventional methodology.
Yeah. You know, speaking of Toxic, I mean, when I first got into watches, the NATO strap of choice that I think was kind of the Toxic NATO of its day, we're talking just probably, you know, 5-6 years ago, was the Maritac straps, NATO straps, which you could buy through, I think in the US or whatever, it was like, you know, broadarrow.net, I think it was, through the military Broadarrow, watch yeah. resource. Maritac, you know, I think they still make a great NATO strap. They're very tough. It's a really tough nylon. The weave is very different from almost any other that I've seen. And it almost has a bit of a sheen to it. It's kind of a tighter weave. And I think, I don't recall, but I think their hardware is sewn in as well. And those are the straps, you know, you'd always see on like the marathon watches. And they just had a real sort of, I don't know, military sort of feel to them, very sort of credibility that kind of came with, you know, the watches that were generally sold on them. I think you got, you know, the MK2 watches, and the marathon watches kind of came stock on Maritac straps. And I still have a couple Maritacs. For some reason, I think the aesthetics of them didn't quite do it for me. So I was kind of happy to see, you know, brands like Toxic and Crown & Buckle kind of stepping up with, I guess it's, you know, bigger corduroy, I guess, is sort of the look that I like.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the Maritac ones are certainly nice, and I have a couple Maritacs that I like that are quite long.
Mm-hmm. Yes, length
for diving.
Yes, yes.
To get it around the forearm of a dry suit, and then I also had a Maritac. I believe it's a Maritac, a single piece Maritac that I used for like a year straight before I decided to buy anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a soft keeper at one end, so you don't have your typical two buckle design or two keeper design for folding it over.
Yeah.
It's nice. There's nothing there that really catches on a sleeve, and I think it's just kind of the most modern expression of a NATO for kind of a military application is with the kind of soft keeper, which is another kind of sideways loop of the nylon webbing.
Do you like, you know, you brought up length, and I think length is something that varies a fair amount between these brands that we're talking about. Like when I look at I've got a 22mm Toxic NATO on right now, and you know, I've got like a 7.25 to a 7.5 inch wrist, and I don't have any tail that I can tuck on this one. It's almost the perfect length to kind of fit through both of those keepers and just touch the top of my watch. Whereas the Maritacs are quite long. The Phoenix ones are fairly long, so you can actually double it back and tuck it under. And I kind of like a little bit of tuck. I think I kind of like the look of it, as well as what you mentioned earlier about just, you know, fitting it over a wetsuit or a dry suit.
Yeah, for the Toxic ones, I have just enough to make it back to the second buckle.
Yeah.
My wrist is about 7 inches.
Mm-hmm.
With the Phoenix, there's not quite as much, I found. So when you fold it over, it doesn't quite clear that second buckle, so it doesn't sit as low.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like ones that are a little bit longer for the utility, but for day-to-day, I found that the standard size from Toxic suits the size of watches that I wear and the size of my wrist, so that I just have just enough to get it back to that second buckle and tuck it down. So you get that. I like the visual look of the fold-over.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why I like it, because it's added bulk, and typically I don't like added bulk in anything.
Yeah.
but there's a certain utilitarian kind of vibe to it that I appreciate.
I guess we need to clarify something here. When you're talking about tucking it, are you the type, so there's two ways to tuck. You can tuck in, or you can roll it back over the keeper and under the second keeper. How do you do it?
I roll it out, but I go back through first and second keeper.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, so I don't try and like feed it under itself.
Oh, okay.
Like I keep, so it's still going out and over, but then it goes mm-hmm. right back under the other keeper.
So it's going under both keepers.
Yep. It just the toxic ones on their the standard size toxic one, if you fold it over, and the crown and buckle ones. If you fold it over, I have just enough to get it, if I tug on it and get it nice and tight in the first keeper, the fold over.
Yeah.
I have just enough to get the tail back to the second keeper.
Ah, okay, I get it. All right. I always fold in on itself, so that's interesting.
I've had leather ones, like the Bremont leather NATO, and in that one I like to fold in. It just seemed to treat the leather seemed to go that way more easily for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And it had a little bit less, so there's no way the Bremont one for me wasn't going to make the second keeper. So you just tucked it in, and it sat relatively flat that way.
Now, the other NATO strap that we've talked about on the show a few episodes ago, I think it was when I was out in Vancouver, was the so-called Zulu Diver.
The 328.
The one from Bonetto Cinturini that we learned about through Farlius on Instagram and bought through Watch Gecko. And that's another just fantastic NATO strap made of rubber that I think you and I both have both gotten a lot of use out of. And that's one that I've worn. I haven't had it quite as long, but I would say almost as regularly nowadays as I do the toxic NATO, and it's holding up, you know, really well. How is yours holding up?
Yeah, perfect. You'd have no idea it wasn't brand new. I took one watch on a trip I went on this past weekend. I took the vintage Sill Vanna Diver and wore it on that NATO, and it was perfect. I mean, I like it a lot because you can, you know, unlike a fabric NATO, it doesn't just soak up all your sweat. So I think there's a longevity factor there, certainly just because it's made out of rubber. I really like the hardware. I like the price. They weren't that expensive for what you're getting. Like, and I honestly think this is the sort of NATO that could really sell someone who doesn't like NATOs.
Yeah.
Because they're super comfortable being rubber, and they're not stiff. I mean, and they also the stiffness doesn't change, so there's no breaking them in.
Mm-hmm.
They're just the same every time you put them on. They also seem capable of holding a very large watch, which not all NATOs are.
Yeah. Although I find if it's a tall watch with a really tall case back, like I tried the 22 millimeter on my Supermarine 2000 and it doesn't work. It's too, maybe it has to do with the positioning of the spring bars in relation to that tall case back, but the way it wraps, there's like this big, the loops, you know, the difference between the bottom strap and the top strap just kind of create this big loop on each side that just doesn't quite work. I think it works better for me on sort of a, it doesn't matter necessarily the diameter of the watch, but it works better for me on flatter watches.
Yeah, but I find it anything from, I think, you know, it's about a 37 millimeter case on my Silvana all the way up to, say, you know, 44 on an SRP 777.
Yeah.
Really comfortable way of wearing a watch. And because there's a bit of a texture to the rubber, like a horizontal line across its surface, it has a bit of the aesthetic of nylon.
Yeah.
Which I like quite a bit, as opposed to, if, you know, if it was just smooth, I think I wouldn't like it as much.
Yeah, I agree. And I think even in photos, sometimes it actually looks like a nylon strap to a lot
of people.
For
sure.
So speaking of rubber, maybe we should move on to rubber straps. Any favorite kind of aftermarket rubber straps that you use?
I have a couple Isofrains, and Isofrains from, you know, like Benaris has their version of the Isofrain.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any preference between the actual brand and any of the ones that have come with various dive watches I've purchased.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't mind an Isofrain. Typically, I find them too thick,
just
for my taste visually. So again, I have kind of a bony wrist, and I find that when you take a watch like a Benaris Moire, I have a Benaris Moire 42 that I really love to wear, especially on a leather strap, it works quite well. But you put it on kind of a chunkier strap like the Isofrain, or this is the same thing with the Tropic, the Halios Tropic.
Mm-hmm.
It almost feels like you're wearing more strap than watch.
Yes. Yeah.
With the Silvana, you sent me a Tropic rubber that I absolutely adore.
Oh, yeah. Old Tropics are so cool on certain watches. They're just so cool.
It's so comfortable. The texture is really cool. The way that it plays with light is excellent. I just really, really like it. It's really comfortable. And on an old dive watch, it looks really cool.
I'm kind of waiting for someone to release a kind of a new version of a Tropic, you know, that almost mimics it exactly, except with a different material. I think that's the only downfall of those is I think they can get a little stiff. I think some of them are a little stiff around the edges.
Get brittle over time.
They get brittle, yeah. And I know that there was, I can't remember who had it, a couple of companies have tried to make modern Tropics, and I think they're... The one that comes on the Oris Diver 65 is sort of a tropic-esque strap. You'd know, right?
The Oris 65, the 40 millimeter with the kind of cool hour markers,
yeah,
has a tropic style rubber strap. Although they've kind of made it their own, it's not exactly like the one that you sent me.
Yeah,
and it's a nicer rubber, and it's very it conforms very nicely to your wrist.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just not really the same overall aesthetic. I mean, the one that you sent me has this kind of ribbed edge and has a keeper, and then the underside has this rather complicated diamond pattern that keeps as much of the rubber off your wrist as possible.
Oh, I love that. Yeah,
and vented, so it doesn't get sweaty underneath, and if you're wearing an old dive watch, it just looks so cool.
Yeah
You know, it's like having the right wheels on an old car.
Yeah.
And I really do like the one that's on the Oris. There's nothing bad to say about it. But it's just not exactly the same thing. They're just kind of two different things.
I think the real key, and you talk about Isofrane and you talk about Tropic. Now, these are straps that came out of a certain time period, and the Tropic was kind of the strap of the 60s, and the Isofrane, I think, was more of the strap of the 70s. You'd see it on Ploprofs and, you know, some of the Eternas and things like that. And on those watches, they looked good. On big dive watches, I think they looked good. The, you know, Super Sea Wolf and things like that. The Tropic was more of the, like you said, the Silvana, you know, like an old sub, an old, you know, Seamaster 300, a little more, you know, modestly sized, sort of real vintagey dive watches. And I think the key with those was, you know, the Isofrane doesn't have a taper. So if you get like a 22 millimeter strap, it's thick and it goes 22 all the way to the buckle. Whereas the Tropic, you know, if it's a 20 millimeter strap, I mean, it'll taper to like 16 or something at the buckle,
down.
which sounds dainty, but I think it works. I think they knew something back then, you know. It looks really good.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's excellent. I'm trying to think if there's any other. Oh, I've used a Hirsch rubber strap. Sorry, you'll be able to hear me like rummaging around in my box here. This is I know I've talked about this on a previous episode.
I've had a good Hirsch rubber strap, now that you mentioned.
So yeah, I've used, it's called the Hirsch Pure, and I don't remember where I bought it, but everybody carries Hirsch, so just Google it. Comes in a few different colors, and it's your kind of stock, straight lug, nicely rounded edges. I want to say they're worth about $60 before any promo codes or sales or whatever at your favorite spot.
Yeah.
And this is actually quite nice. I've used this on my Zin 144, and it works really well. A very comfortable way to wear the watch in hotter temperatures.
Yeah.
And for the money... Because what is a Tropic, if you can find an old Tropic, what's that going to cost?
Well, I think they're pushing $100, 80 to $100, I think now, maybe 60, I don't know.
Yeah, so I mean, if you're not running a vintage watch,
yeah,
but you do want a kind of clean-looking rubber strap, no, you know, it has no design, no patterning, no any, you know, there's not like tire treads or something cut into it.
Yeah.
I think this is what I like the most. It's a high-quality rubber, it's very smooth. It's a little, you know, when you rub your fingers against it, it's a little, not sticky, but, you know, it has like some purchase. It's grippy.
Yeah.
Which may or may not work for the shape of your wrist and the balance of your watch. But for the money, I don't think you're out a lot if it wasn't ideal. It has kind of a nice spring-kept buckle, two keepers, and the far keeper, the one closest to the buckle, is actually secured by two little shoulders.
Oh, I like that.
It stays kind of in place, which is a nice feature on a more modern rubber strap, especially one that's, you know, these are a little longer than something like the Tropic. It's probably a full centimeter longer on the tail. So
yeah,
the Hirsch Pure I've used and have been quite happy with a 20 millimeter in black. I think they also come in navy blue and a nice, like really bright Doxa-y sort of orange.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I think I've seen that. You know, I think the kind of the benchmark well, I don't know about the benchmark, but, you know, there are a few OEM straps, you know, branded straps that come from the manufacturers that came on watches that stand out in my mind for particular quality. And I think, you know, going back to, you know, arguably my first kind of cool watch back in the 80s when I was a teenager was my old Seiko, whatever it was, 7002, and it came on the Z22 rubber strap that has come on every Seiko dive watch since, you know, the 70s, which they kind of recently upgraded actually to more of a silicone strap like we got on our SRP Turtles.
Yeah, for sure.
But this, I've always found Seiko dive straps to be just fantastic. I mean, some people would argue that they're too long, but I think for a diving strap, it's a great length. You know, they're the ones that invented the accordion venting that allows you to kind of take up the slack when you're diving with a strap on the watch. I don't know. Seiko does a great job with rubber straps. I think the strap that came on the one that stands out in my mind was the rubber strap that came on the original Planet Ocean back in the mid-2000s, which I think the later rubber straps that they've done, they've kind of tried to emulate leather with some stitching, and it doesn't quite work for me as well.
Yeah, I know the one from the Planet Ocean had kind of a V-like shape from the lugs.
Yeah, I love that look.
Yeah, those are really cool. Yeah, and those are great straps, no doubt. I would actually disagree with you about the Z22.
Yeah? You don't like that one?
I got one that came with my SKX 007.
Sure, yeah.
And I've worn it diving, and when you're diving, it works fine. It's great. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, I find them really difficult to wear. They're quite bulky.
Mm-hmm.
Due to the venting, so they start to feel a bit like the Isofrain.
Oh yeah.
And then I just found the overall, like, maybe it was the edges are kind of rough. And I mean, it's not an expensive strap, but the one that comes with the 777 is a huge leap forward in my opinion. It's like velvet.
Oh yeah, very soft.
It's really nice.
Yeah.
And that watch holds its weight a little better on those vents.
Mm-hmm.
I like the one that comes with the 777 a lot. I less like the kind of wave strap that came with the 007. That's a situation where on the 007, the Isofrain works really well, or just a really long NATO.
Oh, yeah. Now, you must have had that Omega strap that I was referring to. Did you have that on your 2254 Seamaster? Did you have that rubber strap? They made a version for that.
They did. It's quite expensive to buy separately. So I have the Speedy bracelet. With being the 225-450, it's on a Speedy bracelet.
Oh, sure.
So I never, you know, I flirted with the idea of buying the rubber a few times.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a fitted rubber, so it fits, it's like a fitted end link.
Yeah.
And I find typically those rubber straps where you can't sit the watch flat on a table can be a little annoying. The exception is the rubber strap that I have for my Explorer 2.
Oh yeah.
From Everstraps.
Yeah.
So that strap has kind of a fitted end link and holds its shape, kind of has actual shoulders that would, say, lift the watch off a table.
Yeah.
And that's still fantastic. One disclaimer is that I did not pay for that strap. That was a sample provided by the brand.
Oh, sure.
It is a really nice strap and one that I'm very happy with, and it wears beautifully, and I know we've talked about it before, but it violates that disclaimer I mentioned at the top of the episode. Probably one of the nicer rubber straps I've ever come across, and it should be at its asking price.
Yeah.
But certainly OEM brands, Omega, Breitling, lots, offer rubber straps that cost way, way more. So
yeah, they almost shouldn't cost as much as they do, but I think because they're branded, they feel like they can jack the price up a little bit. And arguably, I mean, they do, you know, they do fit the watch. I mean, they're made for the watch. So they oftentimes the design of them is meant to kind of carry through from the watch. I mean, one example would be the rubber strap that comes on the Supermarine, the Bremont. I don't know what they sell for separately because it came on the watch, but it was a great kind of first effort integrated rubber strap for a dive watch for a company that hadn't really done that before. It's plenty long, it's beefy, but it's comfortable and it's pretty supple, has a nice buckle. And then they did that sort of, I don't know which, how you'd even call it, that texture, that sort of ribbing that almost carries through from the texturing on the dial, which I think
the
is
vertical striping on the really dial nicely carries into the rubber strap. It's cool.
Yeah, yeah. The issue I have with rubber straps is I think you and I have, your wrist is smaller than mine, but I think we have similar shapes. It's a flat wrist as opposed to a round wrist. And the problem I have with a lot of rubber straps is if they're too stiff or bulky, I get this chafing or this cutting on the sides where the strap comes down.
Yeah, for sure.
For me, one of the criteria, a strap can be beautiful looking and fit the watch nicely, but if the holes are in just the wrong spot, I'm either wearing it too loose or too tight because of this, you know, this issue that I have, which is another reason why I tend to wear NATO straps a lot. The holes usually get a lot more holes, and they tend to be closer together, so you can kind of fine-tune that fit.
Yeah, that's where I would land on rubber straps, is I'll wear one, but typically not long-term. Like, I don't have any watch that I just keep on a rubber strap.
Yeah.
I always end up going back to wearing a NATO. I think it's just a much more comfortable fit for me on, yeah, you know, with any of my watches, and I like the aesthetic better than rubber.
Yeah.
I could see there being an exception for certain, like, if I had certain Breitlings look really, really, really cool on the rubber strap.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if you had a watch that, you know, it was, you had something like the Patek Philippe Aquanaut Twin Time, you know, with the rubber strap option, you don't have a lot of other strap options.
Yeah, that's true.
So there's some, you know, things like that. But that would be an example of a good problem to have versus an actual problem. But yeah, you know, with rubber straps, I often find I only wear them for a day or two, and then I switch back to something else.
Yeah. Now, we're kind of coming into fall here. Well, we're well into fall, actually. And I tend to move a lot of watches to leather, at least temporarily in this time of year. You don't wear a lot of leather, do you?
Not so much. I have a few leather straps that I like. I have a couple from Halios.
Mm-hmm.
These kind of nice, really chunky Horween leather straps. I have one in brown that I really like on a 22 mil. I have this kind of really cool, it's their rally strap, the Autodromo rally strap.
Oh, yeah.
And it kind of has, you know, the multi-hole sporty 60s-70s sort of leather strap design. And it's in this kind of really saturated rusty red color.
Oh, nice.
And I like that quite a bit. You know, it can be a struggle to find a watch to match this color. But certainly, if you like wearing black leather, which I don't, mm-hmm, but if you like wearing black leather, this strap in black would look killer on just about any watch. So that's, yeah, the Autodromo Rally. I think it's a 20 millimeter. I'm not sure if they offer other sizes, but that's a very cool strap. And obviously, Autodromo makes a lot of really, really cool stuff.
I'm sorry, I hadn't thought about Autodromo, but I have the Prototipo, and it came with the kind of that perforated leather Rally. And I think, if I remember right, when they came out with that watch, they were trying to really mimic the, I can't remember, I think it was called Corfam. It was this synthetic leather material that they put on old Hoyers in the early 70s.
Oh, cool.
And it was meant to look like leather, and it had this sort of shine to it that actually wasn't leather. And when Autodromo came out with the Prototipo, which sort of mimicked the watches of that era, they made this leather strap to look like Corfam, and they did a great job. And yeah, I hadn't thought of Autodromo, but when you mentioned that, I remembered that strap, and they do make some nice straps.
Yeah, if you have a watch that you think might fit the general Autodromo vibe, check their website. They have a few different straps to choose from, and I think that they all look great as with all of their watches too. And then other than that, I have kind of a handful of straps that are in that kind of the two-stitch variety.
Yeah.
You know, where there's, you know, a little loop on either side up by the lug bar, kind of like the Hodinkee style or Analog Shift. You know, there's so many people offering these straps now.
Yeah.
And I have a few, and those are great. I find that the watches that I would most typically wear on leather don't always accept the leather strap really well, like my Explorer 2. There just isn't enough room, so you'll have this lovely leather strap, and you'll fit it, and it'll look fine, and then you go to put it on your wrist, and as the strap rotates, it just cuts in against the case.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And you end up with this, like, bald patch.
Yeah.
But I do have this kind of gray suede. And if you go to my Instagram, it's like, yeah, like a gray suede with an off-white, slightly off-white stitching and kind of a rubberized edge, black edge on the strap.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe this is similar to one that Hodinkee sells from their website. And that on the Explorer 2, I really love. I think it's perfect for kind of the fall. And the suede is actually like a thick enough leather that even though the case is cutting into the strap, you can't see the damage.
Yeah.
Like there's not a different color at the base of the cut, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And that's probably my current favorite leather strap. Otherwise, I'm pretty hit or miss on leather. I find that if it doesn't taper, I typically don't like it that much, depending on the watch. But I typically end up going back to either a certain bracelet with a certain watch or just a NATO.
Yeah. I mean, I have bags of leather straps, and I maybe it's the season. Maybe I'll start putting more leather on these days. But I, like you, I have a bunch of those two-stitch straps, the Hodinkee-style straps. And I find they tend to work really well on vintage watches. For some reason, you take like an old dive watch or my old, you know, 321 Speedmaster, and it just looks kind of right on leather, even like an old sub or something. But for some reason,
yeah, they look great on an old sub.
Yeah, and I don't know why that is. I mean, dive watches just traditionally just you would never see them on a leather strap, but they just work really well on vintage. So, you know, that or I haven't really tried any leather on my old Doxa T-Graph, but I'm guessing that would look pretty cool on a leather strap.
Yeah, I think so.
One style that I like is the, I think a lot of people call it sort of the Breitling style. It's sort of a padded leather with the full stitch down each side. But you don't see that very often anymore. I don't know if it kind of went out of fashion with the popularity of the two-stitch, but it was kind of a strap I liked on sort of a more of a, you know, pilot or driver-style watch, that sort of padded center with the stitching down the side is a nice look as well. So what about steel?
Oh, yeah, for steel?
I mean, of course, we both recently picked up that awesome $15 steel bracelet that you got.
Yeah, that's the only one I'm wearing these days. That and, I'll occasionally put the Explorer 2 on its bracelet.
Yeah.
But that's really just, that's like a play for variety more than my absolute love of that bracelet. I just like the way that a Rolex looks on its bracelet.
Yeah, I do too.
But I really, really like the Zin on that $15 eBay bracelet. Way more than any $15 watch purchase I've had recently. It's just very comfortable, and I think the aesthetic is perfect, so I think it looks great. But, I talked about it in a previous episode, but
yeah,
that's a cool one, and we'll put the link in the show notes again.
I'm just not a fan of so many bracelet styles. I guess I'm really picky about bracelet styles, and that one hit the right aesthetic, and I think the same with the classic Oyster bracelet from Rolex. I mean, the old, like the old Mark II Speedmasters from the 70s, the ones they would put on the Seamaster 300s in the 60s. Omega did a great job then, but I'm not a real fan of their sort of modern speedy style steel bracelets. So there aren't a lot of bracelets that I wear and like these days either.
I do occasionally wear the SKX on the Jubilee bracelet.
Oh, yeah.
And I find the secret to the Jubilee bracelet is size it a little bit too big.
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't really like my watch to flop around.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, and it could be that Jubilee bracelet just isn't a great example of bracelet.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just size the micro adjustment one or maybe two too big on your wrist, just to give it a little bit more space, it takes on this kind of vintagey wiggle your wrist.
Yeah.
Which I find rather appealing. Again, kind of like with rubber, I'll do that for a couple days and then I'll go back to something else.
Yeah.
So I think the fun thing about straps that we're kind of cornering in is they offer a huge amount of variety for less price than, say, simply buying another watch.
Right.
Obviously, we're not the first people to ever talk about this or discover this, but you can have a whole box full of NATOs and essentially just pick one that matches your outfit that day or pick one that matches just the watch.
Right.
Or whatever. And, I mean, everybody's going to have their different kind of methodology, but I don't think that leather is better than NATO and NATO is better than bracelet or whatever. It's just I think everybody should try a little bit of everything to find where they land on the kind of mount spectrum.
Yeah.
Is it more NATO? Is it more bracelet? Is it more leather? Is it more rubber? And there's some oddball stuff. Like you can get custom straps made by Gas Bones.
Oh yeah.
Carl in the UK. And I have one of those and that's really cool. I have a 00, you know, it's a Velcro closure with two leather positioned keepers to mount the watch into what is great. Otherwise kind of like a NATO.
Yeah.
Really cool, really cool fall option because it's the one I requested. You can he'll make just about anything, but it's a kind of an olive green webbing with a brown, like a medium brown keeper.
Nice.
Or I guess essentially a lug end.
Yeah.
For each side of the watch, and that's pretty cool. And then you have stuff like the Erica's, which of course we've talked about a few times before.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I'm still surprised by, you know, I'm not surprised, but you know, I'll get someone that I don't know, or you see them at a party or a dinner or something, and they look at your wrist, and, oh, cool watch, I love the strap. And they're like, they think that, you know, you're stuck with the strap that comes on a watch. And I'm always telling people, like, just get a box full of straps. I'll happily change your watch strap if you want, you know?
Yeah, for sure. it's a relatively small investment, and yeah, you can get a lot more wear out of watches you already have, because a strap really changes it in like a very fast way.
Yeah.
Lots of fun to be had with straps. And hit the show notes if you're wondering about any of this, and if you get confused, or if you have a really cool strap that you think we totally missed, thegraynato@gmail.com, please send us an email, let us know. I think we're going to move on to, what do you think, maybe tools?
Yeah, I think it's probably a logical segue to move into tools, since, you know, maybe we can talk about strap-changing tools. You know, there are a lot out there.
Do you have a preferred strap-changing tool? There's like a billion.
I don't. I mean, I think initially maybe the first one I bought was probably the best one, and that was one of those Bergeron strap-changing tools that comes with, you know, that's nice grip. They aren't like too sharp of edges. The tips are pretty sturdy. But what I found is maybe I'm just rough, maybe I'm just a gorilla, but I'm always snapping off ends of the fork and ordering new fork ends. And then I've gotten so many of those kind of cheaper strap changing tools, just with straps or, you know, just
free from brands. Yeah. Like it's a fairly typical giveaway.
Yeah.
I only have one of those that I really like, and it's from Nomos.
Huh.
And it's essentially the same thing. You know, it has a spring bar tool on one end and a pusher tool on the other.
Yeah.
But it seems very nice. And for whatever reason, that's the one that I haven't broken or bent or abused in some way.
You know which one was cool? Was that one we got at the Tudor event at Basel last year. The little travel one?
Yeah, the Tudor one is cool. Yeah, true enough.
Super cool. I'd love to see. I don't know if anyone's selling those separately. I don't know where they sourced those, but really cool. Just about, 2-3 inches long. Came in like a little fold-over leather pouch, and it was blunt at each end, and then you just unscrew a cap and pull out the tip, and you turn it around, and it was either a pusher or a fork. And then you just thread it in and off you go. And it was just great. I mean, I just keep it in my travel bag now.
Yeah, that's a cool tool. And I'm assuming we can probably link to at least a photo of it in the show notes. The other one to look at that I haven't seen in person, but from a concept level I really like, is the new strap-changing multi-tool from Worn and Wound.
Oh, yeah.
Did you see this? So it's essentially a thin black bar, and there's caps on both ends.
Mm-hmm.
And you have tools so you can kind of flip it around, whether you want a screwdriver or a spring bar, kind of a V, like a cutout V, or a pusher. But then the center is also threaded, so it comes off into two pieces, so you now have two screwdrivers.
Yes, which is so handy.
To allow you to change twin screwed end links or bracelet mounts.
Yes.
So if you've ever had this, like if you don't buy, say, two Bergeron screwdrivers of the same size.
Yeah.
And then you kind of have that like monkey grip where you hold the one screwdriver with your pinky finger and then kind of grip the case. And then with your right hand or your left hand, however, you get the other side. Because you get these spring bars that have a screw head on each side.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen this tool, but I am very interested in getting one. So I should probably put in an order. I know that I planned to, and I saved it to pocket, and then I just didn't get around to, you know, actually buying one, but I think that's a pretty interesting tool.
And then a few shows ago, you talked about the spring bar tool that you got to swap bracelets. I don't remember who made that.
Yeah, it's the Horofix.
Horofix, yeah.
So I bought this from a company called Esslinger. And again, I paid their normal price. There was no deal or anything with that. And I think they're just a supplier of various watch parts and tools and stuff. So from them, I bought a handful of the Bergeron screwdrivers and then these Horofix. So it's called the Horofix Watch Bracelet Spring Bar Pliers Band Tool. And I paid $90 US for it. And there's a Bergeron version that's, I think, nearly double the price. It's basically a pair of spring-loaded pliers, so they're biased towards being open.
Oh, yeah.
And then they have a screw set that allows you to set how wide open they can be, like their maximum width. And then you have kind of two screw-mounted tips that can slide right into a bracelet point, depress the... then you close the pliers using your hand to depress the two shoulders of the spring bar. And then with the other hand, you just pull the case away. And I'm able to very quickly mount or dismount the bracelet on my Explorer 2 with no scratches. So I think that's a really killer tool. It'd be really nice if they were a little cheaper.
Yeah.
But if you do the bracelet swap frequently, you can do a lot of damage to the back lugs of a watch by just using a screwdriver or something small enough to get into that little space.
Yeah.
Whereas something like this is designed for it. And Rolex also makes their own tool for this. Like, that's specifically designed for their lug width.
Mm-hmm.
But that's going to be very expensive. But I know it exists. I've seen it on forums. I just... It would also be quite expensive. And I'm assuming maybe you can't even just go and buy one. You'd have to supply one through someone.
Right. A couple of weeks ago, you turned me on to a bracelet sizing tool. For years, you get a nice bracelet from on a Rolex or something, and it has, little screws that hold the links together. But a great number of bracelets from, Seiko Jubilee to the one that came on my old Zodiac Seawolf, and more recently, that $15 eBay bracelet has the pressed pins that hold bracelets together.
Yeah, pin and collar.
Yeah, and you turned me onto the little ones that they sell on eBay, and I ordered one up, and works like a charm. It's great. It works like it reminds me of a bicycle chain sizing tool where you just you're just pushing the pin through by just this threaded pin that sort of just pushes out the pin and the link. So
yeah, it's kind of like a metal or plastic channel that you lay the bracelet in, and then a kind of screw set pusher that you control by turning a large thumb screw
mm-hmm.
that will push the link out to the other side, and then you don't have to deal with the little hammer and the pin, or there's 10 other ways I've seen people do it on YouTube that could easily damage the bracelet, in worst case really you mess up that pin and you can't put the bracelet back together.
Right. Yeah, I don't remember what I spent on it, but it was the best,
They should be under $5.
Yeah, it was $5, so.
I've had a few of them. The metal one is the one that I would recommend, and then simply take some electrical tape and lay it down in that channel.
Oh, yeah.
Because they don't do anything to protect. It's just metal on metal with your bracelet.
Oh, yeah.
And, that works pretty well. I like that quite a bit. I have some other weird eBay tools as well. I have, I think digital calipers are pretty fun to have. I use it to measure thickness and case size from different angles for reviews.
Mm-hmm.
But a digital caliper, at least to somebody with a nerdy proclivity, like somebody listening to a podcast about watches, I think is pretty much has some value to just about anyone. And they're very cheap on eBay. They're not great, but they're accurate. So whatever. And then I bought a watch demagnetizer for about $5.
$5. Wow.
Yeah. Maybe it was $10, but it's good. I'm going to say it was an insignificant amount of money.
Huh?
So it's this blue thing that you plug into the wall and it has a button on it.
Hmm.
If you find that you have a magnetization issue with your watch, I had a couple watches that were magnetized and this was simply easier than going to a watchmaker to have them demagnetize the watches. But what I would say is if you're going to buy this, then also go on YouTube and learn how to use it, because you don't just put the watch on the piece of plastic and turn it on.
Huh.
There's like a specific method to using these ultra cheap demagnetizers. So if it's something that you come across frequently, or if you're just nerdy and want to give it a try, they're not expensive.
Yeah, it's stuff like that that I think, like the bracelet sizing tool or demagnetizer, it saves you a trip to, to the watch shop. And I found the same with something else I bought, another eBay tool that I got was this JAXA. JAXXA case back opener, which
right on,
you can just it's got little pins, it's got a handle and three pins that you move in or out to fit the kind of the standard case back style that most watches have. You can't open like a Rolex case with it, with the special tool, the press fit tool that Rolex uses, but most other watch cases I've been able to crack open with this, and it's not something I would recommend just everybody doing willy-nilly, just to kind of peek in your watch in a dusty room or something like that. But on occasion when I've wanted to maybe tweak the regulation on like an old Seiko diver or something where it's running a little faster, a little slow, or you just want to take a picture of the movement in your watch, or, if you're trying to sell a watch or something, or swap a battery in a quartz watch, it's really handy to have.
Yeah, the biggest scratch I ever put in a watch was with one of those cheap tools that only have two points.
Ooh, yeah.
And I was just changing the battery in an old Columbia.
Yeah.
Like a $40 watch.
Yeah.
But one of the little mounts, which are made out of they're made out of like brass or something.
Mm-hmm.
One of the little mounts for this wrench popped out and just dragged across the back of the case. And deep. Very, wow. Very deep. Like, no, if this was a watch you cared about, you would have been looking for a new case back if that was possible.
Wow.
Just destroyed the case back. So learn how to use it, learn how to size whatever tool you buy. And then the other one that works quite well with, at least with some watches that have the kind of, you know, lightly screwed on case backs is there's like a, it looks like a slightly deflated rubber ball.
Oh, yeah.
And I bought one of those. Again, it's like, I think it was an eBay thing for a few bucks. And then you hold the watch, you know, crystal down in your hand and push this grippy, rubbery ball against the back and turn it. And with a simple vintage watch, it'll just, the case back will come off with no tool, right? So you're not digging around with the edge of a knife or something to try and get in there.
Yeah.
And I found that worked out pretty well.
Huh.
The other thing that I really like is... I usually keep a small like detailing brush.
Oh yeah.
So one with a soft nylon. What I'm basically saying here is you can buy ones that are designed for jewelry or watches to clean up your watch, to kind of get the little bits that sit next to the bezel.
Mm-hmm.
Just use a toothbrush.
Yeah.
But you can get a lot of the crud that kind of builds up in the, you know, the little areas of a watch. And, you know, when you take like a macro photo of a watch, you start to see a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, dead skin.
It's whatever it is that, you know, it'll get in right in that little gap between the bezel and the crystal.
Yeah.
And between where the bezel meets the case, there's always a bit of like a machining gap.
Mm-hmm.
And a little a toothbrush, or in this case, you know, I'm currently holding like a little detailing brush, does a really great job of cleaning that up. And you can get some of the crud out of a bracelet. You know, you're sitting at your desk, you're watching some TV, the same way you might care for a pair of leather shoes.
Yeah.
Moisturizing the leather and maybe coating it depending on your climate. This is the same kind of thing. You can care for a watch with just a little bit of protection, because that kind of stuff that sits on the metal is bad for the watch long term. That's where you get pitting.
Oh, yeah.
And other issues, because, you know, stainless steel is only stainless. It's not stain proof. Those are situations where for... I don't know, what's a toothbrush cost? Like $2-3? You probably buy like 5 for $10.
Right.
You could just sit there and really keep the watches in nice condition. Obviously, don't buy something that's hard enough to scratch the surface of the watch.
Sure.
And if it's brushed, don't use a lot of force. You know, that situation, you'd want to be fairly light with your usage.
You know, a few years ago, I went out to Pennsylvania. There's I don't remember what the acronym is, NAWCC watchmaking school that's out there. And they offered a weekend pocket watch course where you can, you know, take a cheap pocket watch and they teach you how to take it apart and rebuild it. And I took the course. It was like a 3-day course over a weekend.
Oh, cool.
And yeah, it was.
Is that with Roland, like RGM?
No, it wasn't with Roland, although I did visit RGM that same weekend.
It's roughly in the same area, right?
Same area. Yeah, Lancaster. There's a great... the NAWCC Museum is there, the National Watch and Clock Museum.
Yeah, very
which
cool.
Which is a, that part of the country, I mean, it's, you know, beautiful sort of Amish farm country, and you wouldn't think it's the hub of American watchmaking, but the old Hamilton Watch Factory's there, this great museum, the watchmaking school, you can pop by and visit RGM.
Very cool.
Highly recommend it. But anyway, as part of that class, I bought a watchmaking kit, and I did it through, and I think they still sell it. You go to timezone.com, and it's like the TZ Watch School Kit, and we'll throw a link in the show notes.
Yeah, I've seen this before. This is cool.
Yeah, and you can just buy this watchmaking kit, and I can't remember how much it is, but they had like different levels of kit you could buy. So like they had a deluxe one, and then they had a simple one. I think I just bought the simple one. And it, you know, it was a box, and it has pretty much everything, all the tools you need to take apart and rebuild a pocket watch. So it was like things like, you know, the paper that you put between the hands and the dial when you're, you know, setting that, the gum, the little gummy pieces that you use to pick parts up,
yeah, for
a couple
sure.
different sizes of tweezers, two different strengths of Bausch & Lomb loops with the sort of the, what do they call it, like the wire that holds it to your forehead, you know, a screwdriver set, you know, just all sorts of cool stuff. And I think it even came with like an ETA, totally undecorated, unregulated 6497 pocket watch movement in some sort of generic watch case for you to practice with. And so I took this course and then bought these tools when I got home. And, you know, every once in a while, I should probably get back to it because I'm very rusty and I don't think I could do it again. But it was certainly a really worthwhile class to take, but it's also nice to have those tools even, you know, for the the loops that they provide and the little tweezers, which can be really handy for, you know, putting finicky screws in a bracelet or, you know, just little stuff like that, changing a battery in a quartz watch or something like that. So, I can't remember how much it was. It was probably fairly spendy. It was probably $100 or thereabouts.
I want to say that the kit's about closer to $200.
Yeah, it could be.
It's in that neighborhood, but I mean, you're also getting some tools where if you break the price down separately,
yeah,
it's not going to be that different. Like if you decided to go to Autofrey and buy this stuff on your own or Essinger, right, one of these suppliers,
yeah,
it's still going to cost you. And do you use a loop? Do you care for loops?
I do use a loop quite often now, especially as my eyesight's getting worse. I mean, if I get a new watch or I just, you know, I want to check some detail or sometimes if I'm just replacing a screw in, you know, sizing a bracelet or something, I use a loop. I tend to use the ones, you know, like I said, there's like a 10 times and a 25 times loops that came with this watchmaking kit, and those are just too powerful. So I just use the simple ones that we've gotten, you know, you and I have probably gotten at watch shows. I think Tudor, you know, gave one out. IWC's, I've got an IWC one. Nomos, they gave out these really cool sort of wooden loops.
Yeah, yeah, those are
in a little box. Those are nice, but they're all, I don't know what power they are.
3 to 6x usually.
3 to 6, yeah. So they're not super powerful, but they're just enough to kind of check some details.
I have, I've had a few of those, the like giveaway gift sort of things, and I always give those away to people who have a watch from the brand. I just find that I don't really like loops. I do have a magnifying glass.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, I think, exactly what I like. My problem with loops, and I have a loop system, a 6X loop system, which is fantastic. It's as good as it gets.
Yeah.
But even the 6X is typically closer than I want to be.
Yeah.
And they make a 3X, but then in a rare situation where you do want to get the serial number from an Omega lug, which is just tiny.
Yeah.
It's not quite enough. But my normal use is just a nice magnifying glass because it allows all the light in.
Yeah.
I find with a loop, and I have a loop that I bought at a mineral and gem show many years ago, a 6X, like a little tiny one. It's metal. It's very nice. Great optics. And that one I might keep in my bag for Basel if you really wanted to pull out a fine detail.
Yeah.
Now I'm sure I'd take the loop system. It's, you know, it's just an amazing loop, but they're very expensive. Whereas typically I just want to get a little bit closer than holding the watch really close to my eyes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for that, a magnifying glass is just perfect. You can buy really nice magnifying glasses, and they still allow, because they're open and because you're not holding your hand or actually around the optics,
yeah,
they allow all the light to still pour in. So I find, while I may not be getting as close to the item, I'm getting a much better view of what it is with a magnifying glass. So that'd be my only tip with a loop is, you know, I would say either go on one of the kind of watch maker suppliers, Autofrey, Esslinger, etc., and buy a loop from them. You know, that'll be up to enough of it'll be high enough level to be useful, or use something like a magnifying glass, or maybe a combination of both.
Yeah, and another good tip is, you know, go to like Walgreens or a pharmacy and get like just the strongest power reading glasses.
Oh yeah, reading glasses, sure, that's a good idea. Then as long as they don't give you a headache. Yeah,
yeah. Well, I mean, especially if you're just using it for watch work, you know, you don't have your hands are both free. And
I like that idea. I may do that.
Yeah.
And then I think just to put a button on this, so you were saying you keep all of your straps and everything in various bags.
It's a mess.
I have a couple years ago, my in-laws bought me a tabletop watchmaker's bench.
Ooh. Wow.
So Autofrey sells them, and I'm sure other places sell them, but it's kind of a bright wood bench with four little drawers on each side. I would say it's about 10, 11 inches tall off of whatever you put it on, and it has a big space in the center where you can put various tools and items and books, and then a large drawer, which is where all my straps go, and then it has four drawers up each side that are long. They're over a foot long.
Yeah.
But not, you know, and this hobby just collects little bits of things.
Yeah, yeah.
So you end up with a drawer full of spring bars, you end up with a drawer full of bracelets I don't wear, and a drawer full of, like, random end links or, like, right, spare links that I don't really know what they're for.
Yeah.
And they sell, I didn't realize it was this kind of fair price. It's $90. And I would actually say if you have like a room where you kind of keep all your watches and all of the various things that go with your watches,
yeah,
this is a pretty cool way to do it. It has some kind of a large open area on the top, like a desk, It has like a panel that pulls out where you can put more things to give you a little bit more purchase. But if you've ever seen a watchmaker's desk, imagine that, but like at one third the size. And it's meant to go on top of whatever desk you already have to get your elbows up high enough.
Nice.
To bring the work area closer to your eye line.
Yeah.
And I've had it for a couple of years and I absolutely love it. When I moved out west, the movers broke it. Oh, and no. And my brother, who's handy with all things kind of wood and nails and that sort of thing, he put it back together for me, and I've been using it quite reliably since, and it's kind of a fixture in my office. So for $90, I mean, that's as much as some of the straps we've recommended.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they're pretty cool. If you have a spot for it, I think that a lot of people are always kind of surprised when they see it or they don't realize that it exists. Occasionally it shows up in a photo on my Instagram and I get a bunch of questions about it. So that's kind of cool stuff. But
I think I want one. And Christmas is coming and my mom listens. So I think add that to the Christmas list. That's great.
Yeah, it's a handy place to store all the various bits and bobs for all that.
Definitely.
So what do you think? Do you think we missed any watch accessories?
I don't think so. I think we kind of covered it. I mean, we've talked on past shows about, you know, rolls and storage and travel stuff. And
we've done the travel thing, I think, a couple of times.
Yeah.
And there's tons of options. And I think probably everybody listening has something they use currently. So I don't think we'll go through that one again.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you think we missed anything, send us an email, thegraynato@gmail.com. We would love to hear about your favorite kind of straps, suppliers, tools, bits and bobs, books, whatever it is that you've got that kind of rotates around the world of watches. But I think we've pretty much beaten it to death for this episode. What do you think? You want to move on with some new business, Jason?
Let's do it. Let's move on.
Alrighty. All right, so it's time for a little new business. This is when we kind of cover anything that's new going on, whether it's trips or gear or whatever, just whatever is new that we're currently working on or enjoying. So Jason, I know you've got a pretty cool, not so new, but new to you watch. What are you sporting these days?
Yeah, I scored a watch that I've had my eye on for the better part of probably 3, 4, or 5 years. It's kind of not your typical watch geek watch because it's battery powered and it's quartz. But I think a lot of watch geeks will know this one. It's the Breitling Emergency. It's an older one. It's from 2000. And it is the Orbiter 3 special limited edition that they made to commemorate the first round-the-world balloon flight, which was completed in 1999. And, you know, if you're not familiar with the Emergency, it's one of Breitling's, I would say, one of their kind of iconic pilot's watches, modern pilot's watches. It's got the analog digital display. Basically, the top end of this watch is identical to their Aerospace, which they've been making since the mid-80s. So it's got the two digital screens, the analog hands, and everything's operated through the crown. But then this watch module, actually slides down into sort of this carrier, which is the rest of the watch, basically, with the lugs and everything. And the bottom half of the watch is an emergency locator transmitter, so like a radio beacon, basically. I'm just smitten with it. This one's actually an unworn edition. I found it on crownandcaliber.com, and I've been wearing it for a week straight. And you know, I've never had this much fun with a quartz watch before. It's fantastic. I love the functionality. I like the look, and just I don't know, something about that added feature of having a emergency locator beacon on my wrist. Just, you know, it has this sort of James Bond appeal, the sort of gadget element to it that just really jazzes me. You know, fun piece. And you know, I've got one of the Breitling Hershey, they called it the Hershey bar rubber straps on order.
Oh, I love those straps. I think they look so cool.
Yeah, so you know, right now I've got it on a Toxic NATO, which is going to be hard to beat. Actually, it's kind of a drab olive Toxic, and that brushed hardware kind of matches with the titanium case of the watch. And so it's chronometer certified, and it's got, you know, chronograph, countdown timer, alarm, second time zone, like perpetual calendar, you know, day date. And then it's got this antenna that you pull out to, you know, let people know where you are if you're in trouble, which, you know, you're warned with, you know, many warning labels all over the box and the back of the watch not to do it, because of course you'll be fined heavily if a helicopter suddenly arrives and you're not truly in trouble. So I don't plan on using that, but it did come with, it comes with this big black briefcase that has, you know, big thick manual in it. And then it has this little test unit. It's like a little box with a microphone on it, a speaker, I guess. And you turn it on, and it's just basically, it's just a radio receiver that's always tuned to 121.5 megahertz, which is the civilian air frequency for emergency transmissions. And you turn this thing on, there's a volume switch up and down, and then you press the watch down onto this test unit, and it pushes a little pin on the back of the watch, the little test pin, and you get this kind of fuzz, and then suddenly it starts to beep and lets you know that the transmitter is working fine. So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's one of these absolute geek sort of activities that I could just sit at my desk and like, oh, I think I should check, make sure my transmitter is working today, you know, so pull it out and play with it.
For those of you who want to see how the emergency works, or specifically the emergency two in this case, you can actually watch in season or series 22, episode 6 of Top Gear. They actually use a Breitling emergency up in the Rockies, and it shows you kind of the actual length of the antenna, and I, you know, I had never seen one fully deployed or anything, and I'm sure it's on YouTube, but it was Richard Hammond used one as they were supposed to come and find him in a couple of kind of burly pickup trucks way out in the woods, and I think that the battery died on the watch before they got there.
Oh, no.
Like the battery on the transmission, but largely that was the conceit of the episode, is that they were in no rush to come and find him. They just left him in the wilderness.
Oh.
it was a funny episode as
they
do with Top Gear, but it was one of the kind of rare situations. It was the more updated version, the Emergency 2, but
oh, sure.
You know, I think that part of the functionality is identical. The wire antenna is quite long.
Yeah, it's at least according to what I read in the manual for this one, it's the length of your forearm roughly, which is, I don't know, a foot and a half maybe?
Yeah, exactly. Like I guess I expected like the little cap to come off and then like a little antenna.
Yeah.
Like on the top of an old walkie-talkie or something. But no, it's this long piece of wire, kind of relatively loose, formless wire.
Yeah.
Because at that point, you're less worried about the watch doing anything other than saving your life.
Right. It's a one-time use only. I mean, once it's deployed, you know, Breitling says if it's a legitimate emergency, they will replace the watch. If not, you're in a bit of trouble. But, you know, the difference between they stopped producing this first generation emergency in 2010 because the satellite system that monitors for emergencies stopped monitoring the 121.5 megahertz frequency.
Ah, interesting.
And went to the 406 megahertz frequency, which is a more powerful frequency. But it also, what it does, the new emergency, which was designed to accommodate that new system, is, you know, there's kind of three aspects to a rescue. And one is, the first is alert, locate, and then the third step is rescue. And it's the alert part of it that this watch that I'm wearing will not do. It won't actually tell anybody that anything's wrong with me or that I'm missing. Somebody actually has to know that I'm missing and send out a search party. What this does is it helps to locate me because it sends out this constant pulse for 48 hours that they can then use as sort of a locator beacon to kind of home in on my position, whether it's, you know, on a riverbank or a mountaintop or in a crashed airplane or something like that. So the advantage of the Emergency 2 is this additional. So there's actually two transmitters in that new watch that operate on both of those frequencies. So it still does the location part of it on the 121.5, but it also has this 406 megahertz transmission that will send a signal to the satellites that are monitoring, and then the satellite will then alert local authorities that, you know, something's amiss, somebody's missing.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah.
I like that. That's neat. I know just seeing your picture of the watch on Instagram had me looking at Aerospace, Navitimer Aerospaces, the early ones.
Oh, yeah.
Because I love the movement and the functionality, and if you haven't played with a modern Aerospace, the current one,
mm-hmm.
They're really cool. They're very lightweight. They make them, I think, around 43 millimeters. Certainly, it felt wearable on my wrist.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's that cool twin digital display, and you rotate the crown to kind of access the various features. And it works surprisingly well for an interface that essentially has only one control.
Yeah.
And I just kind of always have digged the older ones, and certainly the emergency is very cool. And yeah, I mean, that's a neat piece. Congrats on finally finding one after so long.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, it has that sort of pilot's watch vibe to it, but I think like on a NATO strap, it has this ultimate sort of adventure watch. I mean, the water resistance isn't great, so it's not a dive watch certainly, but like for pretty much anything I'm doing that's not diving, you know, I'll wear this, and it'll, you know, it'll gives that sort of element of peace of mind with also this sort of geek factor. And so I'm kind of ready to, you know, hit the trail and hike with it. And, you know, along those lines, my other bit of new business is I picked up a couple episodes ago, we talked about packs and bags, and I recently got a new backpack. I replaced my GORUCK GR1, which was starting to get a little frayed, and there was kind of a hole forming on the inside, which I could certainly stitch up, but that bag had a few downfalls that I wanted to kind of upgrade from, one of which it was heavy, and also it wasn't terribly water resistant. So I got a Patagonia Black Hole backpack. It's the 25-liter model, and it's a pretty stripped-down, top-loading day pack, very lightweight, and it has a kind of a shiny, water-resistant coating on the outside and sort of this ripstop material. So it has kind of a techie look, and I got it in black, so it has this sort of stealth, understated look to it. Nice straps, no waist strap at all. It's pretty minimalist. But it has some nice organization on the inside. It's got a pouch for a laptop. It has some smaller internal organizing pockets. And then it has, in the top lid, it has a small pocket for things like, you know, sunglasses or keys or an energy bar. And then on the outside, another thing that the GORUCK didn't have were water bottle pockets on each side, which I've really come to appreciate, you know, just taking it on a couple of hikes. And it just makes a difference to be able to, you know, reach back and grab a bottle rather than having to stop and take off your pack and open it up. So I haven't had it that long, just a couple of weeks, but I've used it a few times and I'm really digging it.
It's a really good looking bag.
It is. It is. It
comes in a bunch of different colors. It also comes in a 32 liter version if you wanted, I guess, you know, 32 is starting to push like kind of general overnight.
Yeah.
Might make a really good travel bag if you travel fairly lightly. I, you know, obviously check the measurement to make sure that it's not so big that you couldn't, not so tall that you couldn't get it into an overhead.
Yeah,
without upsetting the airline or other passengers, etc. But yeah, I mean, Patagonia obviously makes great stuff, and this is kind of a pleasingly strange looking bag, which I like quite a bit. And it has some sort of loops for connecting on kind of that back spine.
Yeah, it's got the like the daisy chain for like carabiner stuff, and yeah, it's just techie enough, but it's understated enough. I purposely avoided one of the bright colors. I have a penchant for the color orange, and I was reaching for the orange bag, and I thought,
yeah, I'm surprised you didn't get the orange.
I'm going to get the black.
It's super orange.
It's super orange. Yeah, too orange. And with my orange pants and orange shoelaces and an orange watch, I just thought, you know, I got to ratchet it down a bit and go with black.
For sure. Yeah. No, I mean, that looks like a killer bag. And oddly, my first new business is also bag related. I know we've lamented multiple episodes about the difficulty of finding kind of the ideal bag for show duties.
Yeah.
So both of my new business items kind of wrap into one. So this past weekend, I got a chance with a blogtowatch.com to go to Denver to do a social media takeover for Hyde Park, which is a watch retailer and jewelry company in Metro Denver. And so while I was there, I knew that I would essentially need the exact same kit that I take to a Basel or an SIHH. So I thought it'd be a good chance to try a new bag. And I had been looking at a handful of kind of very large shoulder bags, kind of large enough to hold a 15-inch laptop, my MacBook Pro, and a bunch of gear. So a camera, a few lenses, all sorts of batteries, a flash, you know, a USB battery pack, all sorts of cables, all sorts of bits and bobs, and still be able to easily get it on and off an airplane, etc. And I was looking at, the Lowepro Urban Reporter 350, which is a very basic looking bag, but had a bunch of kind of intelligent features. But the reviews kind of suggested that the straps to secure the flap were really annoying to work with. And then I came across one from a brand called Tenba, T-E-N-B-A. I've owned one of their messenger bags in the past and thought it was fine. This is called the Tenba DNA 15, and it holds, as you would suggest, a 15-inch laptop. And then it's just an unbelievable amount of really, really intelligent space on the inside. So it has a camera insert that takes up about 90% of the, or maybe 95% of the inside of the bag. So you have a little bit of space if you want to, say, cram a scarf or a camera strap or something like that down into the one side. And then the insert can come out entirely. It has all sorts of pockets. It has a rear, like, access pocket for papers and pens and things like an admin pocket. And then the top flap has a full zipper. So with the flap closed on what's essentially a messenger bag, with the flap closed, you can actually open this zipper and still access the camera or anything that's kind of in the main compartment of the bag without taking the bag off.
Nice.
And then the flap, lid flap thing, is secured by Velcro, but they've got Velcro that's directionally quieter. So if you just open it, it's quite loud.
Yeah.
But if you pull down as you open it, like if you put it on a table and then pull down on the bag as you open it, the Velcro is almost silent.
Really? Huh.
It's really cool technology.
Is that something you knew about or did you discover it just by accident?
No, it's like part of the feature list for,
really? Huh.
For the bag is that,
wow.
If you know, it's a quieter Velcro. It's not silent. Velcro can't be silent because it has to be mounted to something.
Yeah.
But if you pull down on the Velcro, on the flap as you tear the Velcro, it's quite quiet. And then when you have the Velcro closed, the Velcro, these two pieces of Velcro, which is, you know, maybe fist-sized, each piece, is actually enough to support the whole weight of the bag with the lift handle.
Oh, wow.
But if you want, you can, you know, not if you want. I mean, by design, there's also these two little leashed keepers,
yeah,
that are magnetic but are side clip. So they can't be pulled off going up or down.
Yeah.
It's just a clever design. So you can pop them off with your thumb.
Hmm.
But if somebody pulls on the flap in the direction it's meant to go, up or down,
yeah,
it won't disconnect the little keepers, which is really cool. And then there's some pockets on the outside and around the side. You can get a water bottle in there. And even fully loaded, so I took, I had probably like 30 or 40 items. Raw items in the bag, everything that I listed previously, it would fit under the seat of the seat storage in an airplane.
Yeah. Wow.
Upright, so there's just enough storage there for essentially a laptop, and that's its maximum height.
Hmm.
And then, of course, it would easily lie down as well. The strap's quite comfortable. But basically, this is probably the best bag I've ever used for these needs.
Yeah,
and wow. I used it all weekend at this Hyde Park Watch Fair, and it worked beautifully. You know, the bag was, I paid 200-ish Canadian, 230 after tax Canadian, so it's probably like $170 American.
Yeah,
and I love it. It's in kind of a stealthy gray color. I can't say enough nice things about it. I have yet to find a weakness, so I'm very excited to take it to SIHH and give it a real, like, week-long run for its money. But right now, I'm just absolutely blown away. It's a little on the expensive side, I guess, for a bag, but it's at that price, it's really a no-brainer if it does achieve to be as good as it appeared to be this weekend.
Well, it sounds like it's the right mix of clever design features without being too kind of gimmicky. I think some bags try too hard to kind of wow you with features, and then a lot of them just, they're either so specific that they just aren't versatile enough, or they just kind of are too confusing to figure out. And this one just seems smart, like that directional Velcro and kind of the access for the interior from the zipper. I mean, it's,
yeah,
those are smart features that you could actually use. And I like that it fits a water bottle, a laptop, and your camera gear. I mean, those are kind of three things that are just kind of handy on a road trip. And it's very urban looking too. I like that sort of sleek color. It doesn't look too techy and outdoorsy.
It's inoffensive. It doesn't look like you're about to climb a mountain. It also doesn't look like you're, you know, carrying insurance papers. You know, it doesn't look
right.
Forcibly bland.
Right.
But it's certainly inoffensive, and it has, like, you know, a strong focus on size. You can get different sizes. The DNA 15 is just the biggest one.
Yeah.
And I found it just a really nice way to move a lot of gear on an airplane to another place and then use it as essentially my home base at this this event. So the event was pretty cool, and I met a handful of listeners. Guys, everyone who's listening, it was awesome to have met all of you. Probably a few too many people to simply list out, but it was a blast. Hyde Park does an annual watch fair, which is like a really mini Basel. So there's about nearly 20 brands that actually sent their own representatives.
Wow.
And a lot of really, really special watches to this store. And the store has a Breitling boutique and an Omega boutique, and then like a really big space with a bunch of brands that all had kind of their own case. So everyone from Vacheron Constantin to Tudor to Panerai to Omega to Vortic to Cartier. I mean, there were just a lot of really great brands, and they all had some really, really cool watches because it's fully supported by the brands themselves. It's not just a retail exercise.
Yeah.
And then anybody who wants to show up to this mall can essentially play with whatever watch they want. So that's everything from, I mean, you could come in and play with a Vortic or an Omega all the way up to, man, they had a Hublot LaFerrari that people were going nuts about.
Wow.
I mean, you're not going to see that watch everywhere. It's $350,000.
Yeah. And what's cool is that it was in Denver. I mean, nothing against Denver, but it's like Minneapolis. We're kind of, you know, neither LA or New York where this stuff shows up more regularly. So that's really cool that it was in Denver. That's awesome.
Yeah. And the thing that stands out is not just that it was in Denver, but the quality, the level of watch nerdery within Hyde Park's clients was unbelievable.
Hmm.
So it's one thing that I was able to meet 10 or 12 people who really like the Grenado or a blog to watch. It's another thing entirely that they have a whole group of people who just really love watches.
Yeah.
I met a guy wearing an Oaken Oscar Burnham, who then the same day bought a JLC Universal Time.
Oh, wow.
In steel.
Yeah.
Legit watch guy. I mean, like, had the one of the widest spectrums of, like, value taste I'd ever seen, from something like a JLC to Patek Philippe to Panerai and IWCs and all sorts of, and then of course within those brands all sorts of different branches, and they had some really, really cool watches. They had the Big Pilot Perpetual.
Oh yeah.
But the boutique edition from Miami, so all of the loom and the hands are bright yellow.
Huh.
And that watch didn't last the weekend. It sold.
Wow.
Man, was that a cool watch in person. I mean, like, I've seen that watch before, and certainly I follow Adam on Instagram, and he's got the kind of original version, so I'd seen it before, but in yellow, so much punch.
Yeah.
And they had they have a pretty considerable collection of Patek Philippe there, so I got to see a 5270R. I mean, as far as modern Pateks go, that's pretty amazing. And I mean, what a movement, and it's a lot of fun to just have essentially as much time as you want to shoot a watch like that. And the Instagram takeover went really well. Saw lots of really cool watches, everything from Casio to Patek Philippe, literally. And they had a bunch of watches from the Omega Museum collection. So we did everything from very early Speedmasters all the way up to the full gold Apollo commemorative edition.
Oh yeah.
So they had some really cool stuff there. They also, out of the back, they just walked out of the back and they're like, hey James, take a look at this. They had a 2004 Panerai Black Seal Compass.
Oh, nice.
So, you know, like, it's like, it's gotta be 70 millimeters.
Yeah.
Or more. Maybe it's like 80 or 90. It was huge.
Yeah.
I took a picture of it next to a 47 millimeter Panerai. And it looks, of course, tiny, but this is one of these ones that's limited to 300 units.
Yeah.
And it was unworn from 2004. They had all the paperwork.
Ugh,
and, I posted, if you go to where we did the takeover, was for at HP Jewels on Instagram.
Yeah.
And if you go there, you can see a picture of like a loom shot, because I had my UV flashlight with me. And you could see a picture of like the watch in person, and then next to, I did like a 4-foot picture, and the watch next to a current 47 millimeter Luminor.
Wow.
Really, really wild stuff. I got a chance to see what may now be one of my most favorite dress watches on the market, which is the new, or relatively new, Vacheron 1955 Corn de Vache.
I love that.
And it's a 38.5 millimeter. This one's in rose gold. The original was in platinum. The rose gold's way cheaper. But what a really gorgeous watch. And then you put it on and it's so comfortable. It feels so wearable. I mean, it viciously expensive, being a VC, but just
yeah,
just really, really cool. I had an absolute blast. And if you're anywhere in that Denver area, or really if you just really love watches and want an excuse to go to Denver for a weekend, swing by this event, see if there's some brands you're interested in. I would say even if you have no interest in buying a watch, you're not going to get this level of access a lot of other places. Again, you're talking directly to people who work for the brand, same people you and I would see at SIHH or Basel. And it was a really cool event, and it was so much nerdier and more enthusiastic about watches than I expected a retailer to be able to create.
Hmm.
After having been there for the 2 days that the show ran, I totally get how they've managed to make a show that the brands actually participate in. Because a lot of brands aren't going to participate, especially not when they have to participate while standing next to another brand,
yeah,
or in a room with 20 brands. That's yeah, just not something, that's not the way the Swiss watch industry works.
Yeah.
But they got a lot of traffic, and they got a lot of really cool people coming in, and everybody wants to talk about watches. And yeah, like I said, I got the pleasure of meeting a handful of people who listened to the show, and it was a really fun weekend. And Denver's awesome. Definitely has an impressive base of watch nerds, and some of those guys should really get together and make like a really killer watch club.
Oh, that sounds like a great time. And I love the photos. I'm still, I keep going back to that that Black Seal compass. What a cool piece.
Oh, yeah. That was really fun. I mean, they just, this store had been around for so long. It had been around for 40 years. They're kind of an institution in watch sales in Denver. And they had some really cool stuff. And their watchmakers were awesome.
Nice.
They had a big office just full of cool watches, an amazing collection. One guy had a really cool Reverso 8 Days that had the power reserve as a single digit digital on the back.
Huh. Wow.
I had never seen it before. Solid gold Reverso. Jeez. And then you flipped it over and it was an otherwise clear case back with a little circle.
Huh.
And it said, you know, 4, and that was 4 days of power reserve. It's just super, super cool stuff. It was a really fun weekend for like watches and getting a chance to meet some guys that I, you know, that we know from Instagram and such. And that's basically all I've got for new business. I'm really thrilled about the Tenba, and I'm pretty thrilled that you got your emergency, and that black hole looks great. So
yeah,
pretty solid new business, I'd say.
Very good stuff. Yeah.
Want to move on to some final notes?
Yeah, let's bring it in for a landing here. I've got just a couple today. One is it's a movie actually that you told me about, and I just watched it the other night. It plays on Showtime. So I'm not sure if you don't have a Showtime account or how that works, but
you should be able to find it on HBO Go as well.
Ah, cool. Well, the movie's called Gringo, and it's the story of John McAfee, and that name might ring a bell to a lot of people for a number of reasons, one of which is he was kind of a pioneer of the computer antivirus industry back in the early days, like in the late 80s, and then he kind of sold out the business and took his millions and tried a few different things, one of which was build a yoga retreat in the mountains in Colorado. I think he got bored with that, sold everything, and then moved down to Belize and kind of just set up this. You know, what struck me watching this movie was it was very much like an Apocalypse Now sort of setting, or like a Heart of Darkness thing. He kind of moved into a jungle compound and surrounded himself with some kind of shady characters, local guys that he was using for security because he was getting sort of paranoid the longer he lived there. And then there was this sort of muddy episode where a neighbor of his poisoned his dogs.
So allegedly.
Allegedly. And the neighbor turned up dead like a few days later and under very mysterious circumstances. And then McAfee flees the country. And that was another reason why you might remember him, because it was all over the news, you know, CNN and every other network was chasing him around and trying to get interviews and covering him, and different stories were coming out at different times. And ends up back in the U.S., and just earlier this year, he was on the ticket for running for president under the Libertarian Party. You know, it's like just the most bizarre story, and it was one of these great, you know, sort of small-scale, one-person documentaries, like a camera and the host or the narrator, you know, the person who wrote the movie. And she did a great job of researching it and, you know, chasing down leads and a lot of sort of back-and-forth emails with McAfee himself and interviews with some of his cronies and just really a great story. Like I said, it was two-thirds of the way through the movie, I'm like, this is Colonel Kurtz. You know, he's gone up the river into the jungle and kind of gone mad. And it's fascinating. So
yeah, it's a really, really, really crazy, crazy documentary. And if you like, you know, it's not a true crime documentary. It's just about McAfee, a little bit about his history, and then pretty much picks up with when he leaves the States.
Yeah.
Is when it starts to actually dig in with full details. And, you know, he's kind of charismatic and strange in a way that seems appealing. Mm-hmm. But then they dig in enough and you're like, no, this guy may legitimately be nuts.
Yeah.
Like full on criminal nuts.
Yeah.
And you definitely get like a Kurtz vibe of like a guy who is, yeah, on the fringe of both lunacy and society.
Yeah.
And is just trying to operate essentially external to the law and in some ways external to reality. I really, really recommend it. It's not something you're going to watch with your kids, certainly.
Right. Yeah.
There's some definitely adult themes and conversations and such, but a really fantastic documentary, which is very simple and straightforward in its delivery.
Yeah.
And of course, the McAfee story is far from over. So it essentially takes you to now.
Yeah, really, really a good one. Highly recommended. And then the other just fun sort of final note that I've got is it's my latest food crush, which is Justin's Dark Chocolate Peanut Butter Cups. You know, we don't usually talk about food or drink on this show unless we've got a glass of scotch going, which is often the case. But man, I discovered these on the trip to Glacier National Park. We stopped in at like this little shop in Great Falls, Montana, to pick up some provisions for the road. And I found a couple bags of these things. And, you know, I've always been a fan of like Reese's peanut butter cups anyway. But
oh, for sure.
Like Justin's is this small brand I've seen in the stores. They do like almond butter and, you know, organic peanut butter and all this kind of stuff. And it's like dark chocolate peanut butter cups are, you know, I probably don't have to say anymore because if you like that combination, you know, you probably are either already know what these are or you're going to run out and get them right after the show because they're just fantastic. So
yeah, I know I'm maybe not everywhere, but I know in Vancouver they have them kind of in single packs at Starbucks.
Oh, nice.
That's where I recognize the name, and I've had them. They are absolutely addictive.
Nice.
And yeah, for my final notes, I've got one video and one kind of cool Kickstarter item. So let's start with the Kickstarter item. It's the it's called the Fire Beaner by Outdoor Element. And it's essentially a carabiner that has a bunch of tools somehow built into it.
Hmm.
And it's a really clever design. I would actually just probably recommend people go to their Kickstarter page because by the time you're hearing this, there really won't be much left on the Kickstarter. Hmm. There's 8 days at the time of our recording and they're well over. They wanted $15,000. They're currently just under 70. And so it's a multi-tool survival carabiner. You know, essentially it has a screwdriver tip, a bottle opener, it has a kind of a fully protected utility blade, kind of like a seatbelt cutter, it has a slot for hanging like a ring for your keys if you want. It's made out of stainless steel, it has your kind of typical wire gate for the carabiner, and then it uses what's called an EverSpark fire wheel, which is apparently a very reliable, simple to use fire creation.
Sure.
And I think they're about $12. Let's see. Yeah, $12. It gets you in, and then I'm sure there'll be a little bit more than that if you don't get to it fast enough and the Kickstarter's over. So it looks like they're saying delivery will be somewhere around February 2017. I bought a 3-pack just because I think they look pretty cool, and I like the idea of having the fire starter and the utility blade and just little things like that. Maybe it's gimmicky. I don't know until I see it, but you look at the technology behind the fire starting system, it uses actually like a rod of a certain material, and there's a nice video kind of explaining the product. So check that out. I think it's pretty cool, and certainly I backed it with my own few dollars. It wasn't very expensive. Jason, did you get a chance to check out that
I did. Fire I mean, starter? I mean, who, you know, who'd think you could reinvent the carabiner? I mean, it kind of reminds me of the S-beaner. From, what is it, Night Eyes, that you were kind of jazzed about a little earlier in the year. And, you know, between those two, I mean, it's a pretty killer kind of reinvention of the standard carabiner with some pretty cool tech with that. So I might pick up a couple of those too.
Yeah, I figure anytime that you're backpacking, you probably have at least a carabiner. So this could just be your normal carabiner, and then you have a few extra little tools. Even if they're difficult to use, in a pinch, they're going to be so much better than not having any of that.
Yeah.
Like, maybe it's not as good as your standard fire starter, but even if it's half as good, it's just built into something you're going to carry anyways.
Yeah.
So there's some nice redundancy there. And then finally, my last one is a video from Chris Harris with TopGear.com. So it's Chris Harris Drives is his web series, and this is his coverage of Goodwood Revival, which is a giant kind of car gathering in the UK around vintage cars. And he was part of a race team that was driving a Jaguar E-Type, a pseudo lightweight model.
Oh, nice.
So not a true lightweight, but they have a term for it. These ones that have been modified to race in a similar manner to the E-Type lightweights.
Yeah.
I don't want to say too much about the video because I think it's really beautifully shot, and it captures kind of the overall scene of Goodwood Revival, which is very high on my list of things I would love to do at some point in my life. And then it covers some racing, and all of it's really cool. And of course, Harris is a great host. He's one of my favorite kind of car personalities. So, you know, hit the show notes or just go to topgear.com and check out their video. Again, that's Chris Harris at the glorious Goodwood driving the Jaguar E-Type in kind of a vintage race series. And they're driving very hard. It's really is a fantastic sort of video.
I'm going to check that out. That sounds awesome. I mean, Goodwood, E-Type, Chris Harris, can't go wrong. Love it.
No, certainly not.
Well, as always, thanks so much for listening. Hit the show notes for more details. You can follow us on Instagram. I'm at Jason Heaton, and James is at J.E. Stacy. And follow the show at The Graynado. If you have any questions for us, please do write thegraynado@gmail.com. And please subscribe and review wherever you find your podcasts, or grab the feed from thegraynado.com. Music throughout is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And until next time, we leave you with this quote from the great Ansel Adams. In wisdom gathered over time, I have found that every experience is a form of exploration.